the part that what makes me really believe that Barentine did it was, if you had nothing to do with the case, why was he given immunity? You've been asking yourself the same questions.
Mike Ellerson, the former investigator for the Camden County Sheriff's Office, was right. I had been asking myself that same question a lot. Why had Donnie Barentine, an alternate suspect in the case, been given immunity by Prosecutor John Johnson to testify at Dennis Perry's trial?
Why? What was so that you gave him immunity? Why? That right there was my red flag saying, I believe Butch and him. You know, Dennis didn't do it. Why would you give that? Why was he given immunity? For what? If he had nothing to do with it, why?
Mike Ellerson didn't have answers, and I didn't either. Although, it's not the fact of Donnie Barentine receiving immunity that bothered me so much. That I could understand. That wasn't so weird. But what I couldn't get over, and couldn't understand, is the reason John Johnson had given that immunity.
Finding that said Donnie Barentine was a witness to the death of Harold and Thelma Swain, was present at the scene, and has given statements to other persons about his involvement, his testimony to such is necessary to the public interest.
Why would John Johnson have written that Barentine was getting immunity because he was a witness to Harold and Thelma Swain being murdered? The only person who can answer that question is John Johnson. And he doesn't have any answers that he's willing to share. He's been asked before. In 2007, in an article about this case in the Denver Post, John Johnson said he can't remember why the immunity agreement says Barentine was a witness. At this point, John Johnson is quoted as saying, I can't answer that question. We wrote it that way, and we went forward with it. That's all I can tell you at this point. I don't believe John Johnson. Writing that Donnie Barentine was an eyewitness to the murders wasn't some kind of typo. He wrote that for a reason. John Johnson might not be willing to give us an answer, but there's somewhere else we can look. Over the years, Johnson has prosecuted a lot of cases and sent a lot of people to death row. And looking at some of those other cases may give us a few clues about what happened when Donnie Barentine was given immunity in Dennis Perry's case.
Hi, and welcome to episode 18 of Undisclosed, the State versus Dennis Perry. Now, you'll notice that this is not an addendum. Due to scheduling changes, we actually have a full episode this Thursday instead. My name is Robbie Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here as always with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
John Johnson was appointed as an assistant DA for the Brunswick Judicial Circuit in 1977, and he's been there ever since. He's prosecuted a lot of murders, and he's prosecuted a lot of them as capital cases. Now, that's not unique to Johnson. As one study by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution found, prosecutors in Brunswick were overall 14 times more likely to seek the death penalty than were prosecutors in Fulton County. And John Johnson is good at his job, or at least he's pretty good at sending people to death row. In 2007, John Johnson was even named Georgia Assistant DA of the Year. When then-District Attorney Stephen Kelly nominated Johnson for the award, he cited Johnson's work on the Swain case as a reason he deserved the honor. DA Kelly wrote,
John has always looked for ways to prosecute when others would have given up. He has tried hundreds of cases. 20 years ago, a preacher and his wife were murdered in Camden County. The murder went unsolved for years and was even aired in Unsolved Mysteries. 18 years after the commission of that crime, John successfully prosecuted the case. He literally spent months organizing and evaluating boxes and boxes of evidence.
Since John Johnson has prosecuted a lot of murder cases in the Brunswick Judicial Circuit, it's no surprise that some of the potential jurors at Dennis Perry's trial had previously been on juries before him. One of those jurors had been the foreman of a jury in a previous capital case prosecuted by Johnson, and he also became the foreman for Dennis Perry's jury.
When I went to speak to the foreman, he didn't seem that surprised to see me. Turns out, he had a lot of experience with random people showing up on his doorstep, wanting to talk to him about his experience in serving on a jury for a murder trial. I was just the first person to show up who wanted to talk about Dennis Perry's case. Over the past few years, the other people who've shown up on his doorstep have wanted to talk to him about the other case he was a foreman on. The other case turned out to be the case of Jimmy Fletcher Metters. In the Metters case, the foreman told me, the prosecution hadn't done the right thing. There had been this evidence, he said, that the jury should have seen, but that they'd never gotten it. And as the foreman was telling me about all this, he seemed pretty upset about it. Or rather, I think disgusted might be the better word. People should do their jobs right, he said. And the prosecution had not done its job right here.
In 1987, a convenience store clerk working the night shift at a Brunswick Jiffy Mart was shot and killed during a robbery. There's no dispute that Jimmy Metters was present at the Jiffy Mart when the crime took place. He acknowledged at his trial that he'd been at the store at the time along with two friends. The dispute is over who it was that had the gun and who it was that fired the shots that killed the victim. Was it Metters or was it one of the two friends? Greg Creel and William Arnold, the two friends who were with Metters that night, were never charged with any crimes related to the murder. Both Creel and Arnold were given immunity. They testified at Metters' trial that the three of them had been hanging out that whole evening, but they'd had no idea that Metters had a gun on him. They'd only learned about the gun when they stopped by the convenience store to get a snack, and Metters had suddenly pulled out the gun and killed the clerk. But Metters also testified. He told the jury it was Arnold who'd killed the clerk, and it was Arnold who'd been in possession of the gun that entire evening leading up to the murder. In fact, Metters said, the shooting at the Jiffy Mart had been the third shooting Arnold had done that evening. Before they got to the convenience store, the three of them, he, Creel, and Arnold, had all been riding together on Highway 303. They'd driven by these two houses where people that Arnold and Creel had been fighting with lived, and Arnold put out the gun and fired a shot at both houses. He was aiming for the trucks in the driveway, Metters thought, and Arnold still had the gun on him when they went to the Jiffy Mart. It was Arnold who had shot and killed the clerk, Metters said. Now, obviously, the question of which of these three men had possession of the gun on the night of the murders was a critical factual issue to be resolved at trial. But the only evidence that Arnold had ever been in possession of the gun came from Metters himself in his testimony. Prosecutor John Johnson argued to the jury there was no evidence whatsoever that anyone other than Metters had possession of the gun that night, and that the two cooperating witnesses, Creel and Arnold, had always given the same consistent statement, that they hadn't even known that Metters had a gun until he pulled it out at the Jiffy Mart. At trial, John Johnson asked the lead investigator whether he'd found any evidence whatsoever that might indicate Arnold had ever been in possession of the gun that night. The lead investigator said no, there was no evidence to corroborate Metters' story. And Creel and Arnold both denied that Arnold had shot at any trucks. The jury had obviously understood the significance of Metters' testimony about the truck shootings. During deliberations, the foreman, on behalf of the jury, had sent a note to the judge about it. That note read,
was there any reports filed on the incident of the truck on GA Highway 303 reported between the day, after, or between then and now being shot at?
The jurors were instructed to rely simply on whatever evidence had been produced at trial and were sent back to continue deliberations. They would return a guilty verdict and sentence Metters to death.
I know working out is important, but often it feels like trying to find time for a workout is taking time away from things I really can't sacrifice it for. Squeezing in time for family, work, and hitting the gym feels kind of impossible. Something's gotta give, and usually it's the gym. Body Boss can help. Now you can unlock your dream body with this great 12-week Body Boss workout program at home in just 24 minutes a day, 3 days a week. That's less than 90 minutes a week. You can make that work. Plus, with caring pro coaches and a free Facebook group of supportive kick-ass ladies like you, you're never alone. Try Body Boss with a special offer just for our listeners and get 25% off the fitness guide at bodyboss.com/undisclosed. Order now and get free shipping and a money-back guarantee. This is their best deal ever. Get Body Boss for 25% off at bodyboss.com/undisclosed. 12 weeks from now, you'll thank yourself for starting now. That's bodyboss.com/undisclosed. When I saw the note from the jurors in the Metters case, I suddenly understood why the foreman had been so bothered, almost offended really, by what had happened. Because the evidence that had been withheld from the jury and the defense, the evidence he'd been telling me about, it was the same evidence that he'd been asking about in this note. The jury had been so concerned about whether there was police reports that could corroborate Metter's story that they'd felt the need to reach out to the judge and ask about it. They'd gotten no answers, though. And then, years later, when Metter's attorneys had come to the foreman's door, the foreman had found out those police reports had existed all along. And those police reports showed that about an hour before the murder at the Jiffy Mart, two drive-by shootings were reported on Highway 303. At two different houses, someone had driven by and shot at a truck in the driveway, using the same kind of weapon that was used in the Jiffy Mart murder. And both houses had been connected to men that Arnold and Creel had been feuding with. In fact, in one of the police reports, Creel was actually named the suspect. In other words, there were police reports that exactly corroborated Metter's story about what had happened in the night of the murder. And those police reports also directly contradicted the testimony of Creel and Arnold when they said they'd never known about the gun until Metter's pulled it out at the convenience store.
These police reports were a surprise to Metter's post-conviction counsel, but they were not a surprise to Prosecutor John Johnson. He actually had them the whole time. He just decided he was better off at trial if he acted like they didn't exist. As a habeas court would later note in a ruling overturning Metter's conviction,
when the jury submitted its question, Johnson realized that the jury was concerned about a report of a truck shooting on Highway 303, but did not believe he had any duty to advise the court of the existence of the police incident reports in his file, and therefore stood mute.
It wasn't just the police reports from the night of the shooting that supported Metter's story. John Johnson had also known that, just 2 months after the murder, one of those houses off of Highway 303 had been attacked again. And this time, there was a witness who identified Creel as the attacker. And the lead investigator would eventually admit, in his testimony at a habeas hearing, that he'd known all about the dispute that Creel and Arnold had with the people at the houses that had been shot at. In 1994, Metter's filed a habeas petition alleging ineffective assistance of counsel. 11 years later, in 2005, the habeas court that heard the petition granted it, finding that Metter's had established that his counsel had indeed been deficient. The state appealed, and in 2006, the Supreme Court of Georgia reversed the decision, concluding that Metter's claim had been procedurally barred. Metter's appealed again, first to a federal district court, then to the appellate court. 3 months ago, in August, the 11th Circuit issued its order denying Metter's any relief, finding that under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, the Georgia court's decision had not been unreasonable enough to warrant reversal. Which means, barring an unlikely appeal to the Supreme Court, Metter's will remain on death row until he's executed.
This case, the Metter's case, it's not a case in which a defendant is alleging complete innocence of the charges against him. And the evidence, from what I've seen, probably wouldn't support the claim that Metter's didn't have some degree of culpability in the crime, the robbery if nothing else. Metter's had testified at trial to his involvement in that. Even under Metter's own version of the story, a jury could have found him guilty of murder under some theory of accomplice liability. He was there, he participated in the robbery, and he could be guilty of felony murder, even if he never intended for the clerk to be killed. But if John Johnson hadn't chosen to put witnesses on the stand who lied about the existence of those Highway 303 police reports, and if Metter's had been given access to the evidence that corroborated his version of events, that would have given him strong evidence to present that Creel and Arnold were lying. And if so, rather than believing the state's version of the case, the jury may very well have believed some version of Metter's story, that Metter's was there, but that he hadn't been the one who fired the shots. That might not have changed the jury's verdict in this case, but there's good reason to think that it might have changed the jury's sentence. That evidence that John Johnson withheld and that the jury never saw may have been, quite literally, the difference between the life and death of Jimmy Metter's.
The foreman wasn't the only potential juror at Dennis Perry's trial who'd been a juror in a capital case before. There was at least one other potential juror who had as well, though he didn't make it onto the Dennis Perry jury. During jury selection, he informed the court that he now believed he'd sentenced an innocent man, or well, an innocent boy, to death due to how John Johnson had prosecuted the case he'd been on, and so he did not think he could be an unbiased juror in another trial prosecuted by Johnson. That case had been the case of Larry Jenkins, a 17-year-old special education student with serious cognitive and intellectual limitations who was convicted and sentenced to death.
The crime took place in January 1993 in Wayne County, one of the five counties in the Brunswick Judicial Circuit. One evening, in the little town of Jessup, a woman and her 15-year-old son drove their van over to the laundromat they owned to collect quarters from the machines there. They never returned home. Their bodies were found the next day. They had been shot and left by the train tracks. Larry Jenkins had been connected to the murders in some way. That part isn't in doubt. The day after the murders, Jenkins and three of his friends were pulled over that evening while driving around in the victim's van, and they'd had rolls of quarters they tried to trade in for cash. All three friends were given immunity to testify against Jenkins. Only Jenkins was charged. And when Jenkins was interrogated, a police officer wrote out a statement for him which implicated Jenkins as the sole perpetrator of the murders. Jenkins signed it. However, at trial, his attorneys had successfully gotten the statement suppressed. The trial court ruled that the statement was unreliable due to Jenkins' intellectual limitations and the fact that it had been written for him by someone else. There was also no recording of the supposed confession to show how Jenkins had been persuaded to sign the statement. An attorney named Kenneth Carswell was appointed as Jenkins' defense attorney. This appointment was made over Carswell's objections. He did not want to represent Jenkins. He was pretty vocal about this, too. During trial, he kept writing notes to himself about how much he didn't want to be representing Jenkins, how much he hoped Jenkins got convicted. And as the habeas court wrote in its 2005 decision overturning Jenkins' conviction,
prior to closing arguments, Carswell wrote down, "I could not go back to Jessup if Larry walks." Similarly, Carswell noted his discomfort with representation. "When defending a criminal case, the court personnel make you feel like a stranger in a strange land," he wrote. Later, he wrote, "If he is acquitted because the statement was excluded, how could I continue to live in Jessup? How could I live with myself?"
It wasn't just that Carswell was worried about what people would think of him if his client were to be acquitted. Carswell also had a busy caseload. One of his clients was a man named Woods. Woods was a regular client of Carswell, a really regular one. During the time between Jenkins' arrest and his appeal, Carswell represented Woods on 8 different occasions. Woods was well known and widely feared in Wayne County. And Woods was also the man that Larry Jenkins told his attorneys was the actual killer in his case. It was Woods, he said, who planned the murders and shot the victims. When Carswell became aware of this fact, that his client in the capital case was alleging his regular client was the actual murderer, Carswell did not seek to withdraw from either case. He just continued to represent both. But in Jenkins' case, he didn't represent him very well. Take the matter of Jenkins' cognitive limitations. He was a special education student who had never passed a grade of school in his entire life. His test scores, quote, demonstrated that Jenkins is operating at the lowest 1 or 2% of the population. And a footnote in a 2005 trial court opinion noted that,
on the developmental test of visual motor integration, which Dr. Deming administered on November 9, 1999, Jenkins' standard score was 66, and his age equivalent level was 8 years, 7 months.
Prosecutor John Johnson argued that Jenkins' low IQ scores were due to testing methods that were culturally biased against African Americans and not due to any cognitive limitations Jenkins may have had. And under Georgia law, it was Jenkins that had the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that he was, quote, guilty but mentally retarded. Due to his counsel's ineffectual defense, the jury didn't find Jenkins had proven his cognitive limitations beyond any reasonable doubt.
I gotta say, we could stop right there, right now, and I would already be deeply disturbed by what happened in Larry Jenkins' case. This was a horrible crime, and the community had a strong belief that someone needed to pay for it. But I struggle to see how seeking the execution of Larry Jenkins was an act in the furtherance of justice. And that's not where the story ends, because John Johnson had known something the defense hadn't. Actually, he'd known quite a few things the defense hadn't.
First, John Johnson had known that a key witness for the state, a woman who identified Jenkins as the man she saw with a gun after the killing, well, she had initially told the police that she had seen a man that night, but she hadn't known him and couldn't identify him. as the 2005 trial court held.
Assistant District Attorney Johnson elicited testimony at trial from the eyewitness that she knew the petitioner, and it was he she saw with a murder weapon after the crimes, when Mr. Johnson knew she had made a prior inconsistent statement on the day the petitioner was arrested. Her prior statement to the police immediately after the event that she had seen the man with the gun clearly and did not recognize him would have been powerful exculpatory evidence and could have changed the outcome of the trial.
Second, John Johnson had known that the jailhouse informant, the one who testified that Jenkins had confessed to the murders with him while in jail, he had a history of severe psychiatric issues. In fact, Johnson's own office had a psychiatric evaluation of the informant, and it said that if this informant was, quote, found guilty of the pending charges against him, there was sufficient evidence to substantiate the consideration of a guilty but mentally ill plea. Third, John Johnson had known about a police statement that had been given by the girlfriend of the alternate suspect, Mr. Woods. She had told the police that on the night of the murders, Woods had shown up at her place with bloodstains on his clothing and with a gun and some jewelry he wanted to pawn. And the girlfriend believed Woods had been involved in the murder. Fourth, John Johnson had known that after police had received this tip from Woods' girlfriend, they went and interviewed Woods himself. Woods had provided the police with an alibi, but that alibi, as it would turn out, was false. The people that Woods claimed he had been with later testified they had never seen him that night. And fifth, John Johnson had known that the gun used in the Jessup murders had been stolen. It had been taken from a home break-in. And Johnson knew that Woods was a suspect in the burglary. Nevertheless, at Jenkins' trial, John Johnson had objected strenuously to all of the defense's attempts to introduce evidence that pointed towards Woods, and not Jenkins, as the trigger man who committed the murders.
In 2005, the United States Supreme Court ruled in Roper v. Simmons that juveniles under the age of 18 are ineligible for the death penalty. Jenkins' death sentence was vacated. A trial court in Georgia, in a separate ruling, also vacated the verdict, finding that Jenkins had had ineffective assistance of counsel. Not only had Jenkins' attorney been hopelessly conflicted as he represented Woods, the alternate suspect, but the defense had repeatedly failed to take even the most basic steps necessary for an effective defense. Moreover, there were at least 9 people who had information linking Woods to the laundromat murders, and defense counsel had never interviewed any of them. In 2014, Larry Jenkins went to trial again. This time, at his second trial, the confession that had been suppressed at the first trial for being unreliable, the one a detective had written out for him and that he'd signed claiming to be the sole perpetrator, well, it wasn't suppressed. It came into evidence. He was convicted of both murders once again and given 2 life sentences.
Ever since I moved into a new house last year, I have been collecting pieces of furniture to turn my house into a home. And one of my most recent pieces, and one of my favorites, I have to say so far, is this beautiful indigo-colored upholstered rocking chair from Article. Let me tell you about Article. It's an online-only furniture company. It's Scandinavian simplicity. They're beautifully designed pieces, very modern-looking furniture, but also really cozy because that's like kind of the look I like. Now, the thing about Article is this. They eliminate the layers of traditional retail. Because it's online, they're able to keep prices low and quality high. There's no showrooms. There's no salespeople. There's just savings. And here's the amazing thing. I have ordered a lot of furniture online. It costs a lot to be delivered, but with Article, no matter how many items you order, every single order is shipped at a flat rate of $49. Believe me, if you ever ordered furniture online and had it delivered, or ordered it anywhere and had furniture delivered, you know you do not get furniture delivered for $49. And if you need some help getting set up, well, Articles has option for in-room delivery and for assembly assistance. And their in-stock items can be expected in 2 weeks or less. I got my chair like in, I think, a week, 10 days, and they took it all the way up to my bedroom, and it's in a corner right next to my bed. I love it. I love it, and my cats love it, and so does the baby. They always fight over that chair. Anyway, Article also has a 30-day return policy. They've got some of the best customer service in the business. And right now, Article is offering our listeners $50 off their first purchase of $100 or more. To claim it, just visit article.com/undisclosed. That's all it takes. Go to article.com/undisclosed, and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/undisclosed, and get $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more.
The The Jenkins case is also not a case that raises a question of actual innocence on all charges. Larry Jenkins was involved in the robbery, and he has said he was present when the murders happened. Same goes for Jimmy Metters. But that doesn't make what happened here any less wrong. There's no amendment in the Constitution that says it's okay for the prosecution to withhold evidence just as long as someone who's guilty of something ends up in prison, in which case we'll just call it all even. Justice has to require, at least to some degree, the search for the truth, not just the search for a conviction. That didn't happen here in either case. And in both of these cases, John Johnson chose a trial strategy that maximizes his chances of ensuring that some defendant, any defendant, would be convicted of murder and sentenced to death. It's this Darwinian version of criminal justice, where you choose who to prosecute based not on who is most culpable, but based on who is least able to defend themselves. It's a strategy of pick one to prosecute and let the rest walk free, even when the ones you're letting walk free may have had a bigger role in the case than the, say, cognitively limited juvenile that you decided to go after. And then, of course, there are the cases of actual innocence, cases where you end up prosecuting the one who didn't do it and letting the ones who may have done it walk free. Cases like the Larry Lee case.
The Larry Lee case was also a case out of Wayne County. In 1986, Larry Lee and his brother Bruce broke into a house intending on burglary, but they were still there when the homeowner, Charles Moore, returned. There was a shootout, and both Larry Lee's brother and the homeowner were killed. Larry Lee himself hadn't fired a weapon, but he was guilty of murder under the felony murder rule and sentenced to life in prison. Larry Lee does not dispute this felony murder conviction. His role in that case is not contested. But after Larry Lee's arrest in that case, he found himself charged with another murder, this time a triple homicide. It had happened months earlier. One morning at around 6 a.m., someone had broken into the home of Clifford Jones. He, his wife, and his son had all been murdered. They were brutally beaten, shot, and stabbed to death, and the banker's bag of money, the proceeds from the restaurant that the family owned, had been stolen. The investigators decided to charge Larry Lee with a crime. He was convicted and sentenced to death. The case was prosecuted by District Attorney Glenn Thomas. That's the same DA you might remember who refused to prosecute Donnie Barentine because he, quote, wouldn't have whores and crackheads in his courtroom. Anyway, DA Glenn Thomas had only two pieces of evidence against Larry Lee, and the first was Lee's sister-in-law, Sherry Lee. Sherry Lee had been the getaway driver in the burglary, the one where the homeowner and Lee's brother had been killed. And initially, she maintained that she had no knowledge of the Jones family triple homicide. But by the time of Larry Lee's trial, she was testifying that Lee and his brother had killed the Jones family. As the habeas court would write in a 2008 decision overturning Larry Lee's conviction,
Sherry Lee, who had on three separate occasions denied any knowledge of the Jones murders, made the first of three statements incriminating petitioner only after the prosecutor team 1, falsely told her the state had evidence implicating her in the Jones murders, 2, suggested that she might be eligible for the $25,000 award, and 3, told her that she had failed the polygraph examination, and then only after she was granted immunity from the prosecution. As the investigating GBI agent acknowledged in the evidentiary hearing, the statements are themselves conflicting and clash with the trial testimony of Ms. Lee. Moreover, when placed in historical context, the statements reveal a pattern in which Ms. Lee's accounts varied according to the evidence the state sought to incorporate in or to excise from her story.
In other words, Sherry Lee got the Jay Wilds treatment. Initially, she denied knowing anything, but when promised money and that she wouldn't be prosecuted, she began to implicate Larry Lee. Only she couldn't keep her story straight. Every time investigators learned something new, Sherry Lee's story would change to include whatever the new information was that the cops had, even when the new info the cops had turned out to be wrong. Of course, the DA of the Brunswick Judicial Circuit never told the defense about all of Sherry Lee's inconsistent claims, making it impossible for Lee to defend himself against her testimony.
The second piece of evidence that the state had against Larry Lee was a jailhouse informant. And seriously, this informant and everything having to do with him, well, it's just a full-on shit show. If you want to know more, you can go to our site and read the record for yourself, because I'm not even going to try and explain it all here. This informant was lying, that's very clear. But his story also kept changing, and the prosecution was just scrambling to explain each new lie the informant came up with. And anyway, rather than get into all the painfully ridiculous details of it, I'll just leave it to you with how the habeas court ruled in 2008. The court held,
"The prosecution's attempt to clean up their key witness's lie was itself a lie and a fraud committed upon the court in this case."
At the habeas hearing, the prosecution tried to blame all this on the jailhouse informant. They claimed that the informant had somehow bamboozled investigators with some tricky bit of deception. The habeas court wasn't having any of it, though. Quote, "Given that the informant's prison records places IQ in the range of mental retardation, the court is dubious of the suggestion that the informant would have been clever enough to have pulled off the trick."
It gets worse, though. D.A. Glenn Thomas repeatedly told the jury that this informant had no motive to lie, when in reality, as the habeas court found, quote, "Indeed, the informant received virtually every benefit that could accrue to someone in his position." The judge wasn't kidding about that. The informant got virtually everything an informant could hope for. Trustee status, promises of leniency for future charges against him, the DA instantly and personally dismissing new assault charges filed against him, etc., etc. There were other Brady violations in this case, too. For instance, the DA neglected to tell the defense that there was an eyewitness who, right after the murders, saw a car speeding away from the crime scene and that the car was inconsistent with Larry Lee's guilt. The state also didn't reveal that a second eyewitness who claimed at trial to have seen a car like Larry Lee's speeding away from the crime scene had initially told police she'd seen an entirely different kind of car. Actually, there's like half a dozen more Brady violations going on in this case, but we're going to skip ahead for now and go to two specific issues brought up in the 2008 opinion because of how familiar they seem after looking at Dennis Perry's case.
First, the state withheld evidence that a key witness had, quote, "serious emotional and personality problems," to the extent that the witness's psychiatrist actually wrote to the DA begging him not to call her at trial, saying that she was too mentally unstable and volatile to testify. DA Glenn Thomas responded by writing to the psychiatrist with a list of facts that he, quote, "needed the witness to testify to," and specifying the exact details he would need her to say at trial. The DA wrote in his letter,
"These little things are very material for the state, and I only hope you can help the witness to be able to help us to be able to convict those responsible for this triple homicide."
Those little things, of course, were things that contradicted the physical evidence and supported the story that the state wanted to tell about Larry Lee. The habeas court, in its 2008 opinion, had harsh words for DA Glenn Thomas's efforts to coach this witness, but it also had harsh words for the trial court itself. Because the judge at Larry Lee's case had also received letters about how mentally unstable the witness was, and that judge had had undisclosed ex parte contact with the DA about it. The habeas court held,
"The fact that the trial court would have such a contact with the state outside the presence of the defendant and his counsel is appalling to this court, but is unfortunately consistent with the trial court's willingness to let the state, quote, run the show with respect to the trial of this case, compliance with discovery requirements, and duty to see that justice was done in this case."
The second thing from the Larry Lee case that feels so similar to the Dennis Perry case is how the state recorded witness interviews, or rather, how it didn't. Instead of recording interviews with the state's key witnesses, the investigators took notes during the interviews, then wrote summaries of those notes, and then destroyed any original notes or recordings from the interviews that they had. And then the state claimed that since there was no longer any original records from those interviews, the defense wasn't entitled to copies of these summaries because, as summaries, they couldn't be used to impeach the witnesses anyway. Well, the habeas court wasn't having any of this. In its decision, it wrote,
"The state cannot have its investigators choose not to record a statement by a witness, make notes of the witness's statements, later summarize the notes, throw away the original notes, and then say that the summaries are not witness statements. Such flies in the face of all fundamental fairness and is more akin to the Nazi Secret Service investigations than those required by the laws of this state and nation."
In the Larry Lee case, the problem with the prosecution's case wasn't just that its evidence was thin. There was also substantial evidence that someone else was guilty of the murders. Not Larry Lee and his brother, but another set of brothers. In fact, one of the initial investigators on the case, Detective David Dowdy, had come to the conclusion that Larry Lee was not involved. It was the Yarbrough brothers who'd killed the Jones family. In fact, the Yarbrough brothers later were caught committing another murder, similar to the Jones murder, and they went to prison for that. But if it was the Yarbrough brothers that actually killed the Jones family, we'll never know. Because the state ensured that all forensic evidence was destroyed and unavailable for testing.
And there was forensic evidence in this case. A lot of it. 47 fingerprints and palm prints were found at the crime scene, as well as unidentified hairs. None of them belonged to Larry Lee or his alleged accomplices. The jury never heard about any of that, though. Larry Lee's defense counsel failed to introduce any of its evidence at trial. Moreover, he failed to request a court order directing the state to preserve such evidence. As held in the 2008 court opinion overturning Larry Lee's conviction,
counsel's omissions in this regard have had profound consequences for petitioner's continuing efforts to establish his innocence, as the state has lost or destroyed the exculpatory fingerprints and hairs, and has destroyed the family room rug from which additional trace evidence could have been obtained.
It's not clear what happened to those 47 fingerprints. Like much of the evidence in Dennis Prey's case, they're just gone, and no one can explain how or why that happened. Just gone. But as for the family room rug, there's no mystery. We know exactly what happened to that.
On July 12, 1999, Larry Lee's habeas attorney sent an open records act request to the district attorney's office, seeking access to the evidence in the Lee case. Prosecutor John Johnson wrote back to Lee's attorneys, and like many of John Johnson's letters to defense attorneys, it's pretty much just snark. Snarky letters to opposing counsel is kind of John Johnson's go-to move. Anyway, in the middle of another sarcastic diatribe, in this letter to Larry Lee's attorneys, John Johnson included the following line, noting that he, quote, assumed Lee's attorneys will be trying to present the supposed evidence in some kind of hearing regarding Larry Lee. In other words, John Johnson knew exactly why Larry Lee's attorneys were trying to find the evidence in the Lee case. 3 days later, prosecutor John Johnson wrote another letter. This letter was to the GBI, and it said,
this is to authorize you to destroy the large piece of rug you all still have in storage in this case. As you know, this case was tried some time ago and the defendant was convicted. We are now in state/federal habeas corpus proceedings. Even if the case were to have to be retried, I would not expect this item to be introduced into evidence or needed. Sincerely yours, John B. Johnson.
And that's why the rug in the Larry Lee case is gone. Once John Johnson found out that Larry Lee had attorneys who were looking into filing a habeas action for him, John Johnson destroyed it. Larry Lee's attorneys eventually got this letter from the GBI, but before that happened, before they actually knew what happened to the rug, they got a chance to depose Johnson, and they asked him about what had happened to all the evidence in the case, why it was missing. Here's the section of the transcript where Larry Lee's attorneys asked John Johnson about why it was all gone.
Have you ever requested or instructed anybody at the GBI to destroy or dispose of any of the physical evidence in this case?
No.
Is there ever a situation or instance in the district attorney's office where you requested that the GBI go ahead and dispose or destroy evidence? Or is that up to them?
You used the term ever, and the answer to that question would be yes, but not in this case.
That was a lie, told under oath. Because John Johnson had personally written to the GBI and ordered the rug's destruction as soon as he'd learned that a habeas petition might be filed.
As a result of all the Brady violations and as a result of the profound ineffectiveness of Larry Lee's defense attorney, his conviction was overturned in 2008. In 2015, the state dismissed all charges. He was taken off death row and is now eligible for parole.
Had the jurors been presented with evidence concerning the key state witnesses' biases and motives for testifying, and had the jury been aware of the false testimony presented to it, there is a compelling likelihood that the jury would not have reached a unanimous verdict recommending that the petitioner be put to death.
Looking at Prosecutor John Johnson's prior cases, there's definitely a pattern. And I think that pattern carried over to Dennis Perry's case, too. When I first talked to juror Donna Turner, I'd been so confused about some of what she recalled about the case. Much of what she remembered had been detailed and accurate, but sometimes those details were combined in ways that made me feel like I was looking at a funhouse version of the case. But the way Donna Turner combined those facts explains why she, more than any other juror we talked to, had found Dennis Perry's case to be so emotionally and morally challenging.
Valentine's Day is when it was over and we could go home. And I called my husband and I said, come get me. And when you do, don't bring the kids. I had him take me to, I'm gonna cry, sorry. I had him take me to Overlook Park on Highway 17 and I squalled. And I told him that I was so frustrated because I truly felt like that the wrong man had went to prison, that we had to base it on whatever evidence they would allow to be presented. And I really, really felt that a guy who was granted immunity, who sat on that stand, was the guy who did it. Period.
Thank you. At first, I couldn't understand where Donna Turner could have gotten all this. The idea that Donnie Barentine and Dennis Perry could have committed the murder together made about as much sense to me as believing that Daffy Duck and Lex Luthor had teamed up to commit a crime. Those two things don't go together, and they're not even from the same universe. But then, as we kept talking, I slowly began to realize that the way Donna Turner had interpreted the evidence made perfect sense. Because the prosecutor himself, through his immunity agreement, had told the jurors that's what happened here. Donnie Barentine's immunity agreement says he was a witness to the Swain murders, so of course Donna Turner believed that's what happened. Why would a prosecutor have said that if it wasn't true? The only thing Donna Turner didn't understand was why he'd gotten that immunity.
It's because I remember coming home and telling him, I don't know what his involvement is in some other things, but evidently, you know, either he's big time drugging and he's got some good info for the state or something, you know, for him to be granted immunity because he should have, I don't agree with that.
There is no evidence that Donnie Barentine provided any information to the state, good or otherwise. There's also no evidence whatsoever that Dennis Perry and Donnie Barentine had ever laid eyes on one another before the day that Donnie Barentine had testified at Dennis Perry's trial. There just isn't any. No one I've spoken to, in Camden County, Georgia, or in Marianna, Florida, or anywhere else, has ever suggested to me that Donnie Barentine and Dennis Perry could have known one another. But this theory is why Donna Turner voted to convict Dennis Perry, even though it wasn't Dennis Perry that she thought the evidence really pointed at.
We saw the composite before he ever came into the courtroom, if I remember right. And oh God, when he walked through that door, I was like, holy cow, that's your guy right there.
For Donna Turner, like for many of the other jurors in the case, that color composite image had been a significant piece of evidence. It's just that to Donna Turner, it wasn't Dennis Perry it depicted. Donna Turner just hadn't known who it depicted until Donnie Barentine had walked into the courtroom.
And I wish I could remember the guy's name, but for the life of me, I cannot. But the guy that was granted immunity. If that sketch was not his twin, I'll kiss your grits.
In most cases, convincing even one juror that someone else, other than the defendant, committed the crime would be great news for the defense. It only takes one juror to hang a jury, after all. But in this case, convincing Donna Turner that Barentine was the real killer didn't actually do anything to help the defense. If anything, it hurt it badly.
And I'm going to go back to Barentine because still I'm just convinced he pulled the trigger, he shot those people, and he had motive. I just believe that with everything I've got.
Because Donna Turner came away from the trial thinking that the evidence against Donnie Barentine didn't mean Dennis Perry was innocent. It just meant that Donnie Barentine and Dennis Perry were guilty together.
What was your understanding of what he did do?
That there was a church service going on in Spring Bluff, and that he and Barentine both went into the church during the service, and that they together murdered this couple. Shot the deacon's wife. Now, do I really believe that in my heart? That the guy we sent to prison was inside the church? He may have been in the car, but I never believe he went in the church.
My guess is that once we finally get transcripts of the closing arguments, Dennis Perry's case, we're going to realize that this theory about what happened is not Donna Turner's theory at all. My guess is that this is all Prosecutor John Johnson's theory, as explained in his closing arguments. Because the evidence Donna Turner recalls definitely didn't come up from any of the parts of the trial we do have. For instance, remember how Donna Turner recalled there being evidence of Dennis Perry's DNA being found at Rising Daughter? Well, it wasn't just Dennis Perry's DNA that she recalled them finding there.
So you feel confident he was there at the scene?
This is what I'm confident of, and I'm going to tell you this. What I'm confident of is that him and Barentine were together at some time, because there's two bottles with both DNAs in the churchyard.
Again, this isn't what happened. Two Pepsi bottles were found at the scene, but the state of Georgia lost them before they could ever be tested for DNA. There were two Pepsis, though, and maybe that could mean there were two people.
I know that the attorney had to have said, and this would have been the prosecuting one, not the defense, that the bottles put them together.
To be clear, I don't think John Johnson literally said this at closing arguments, not in the strong sense that Donna Turner recalls. But Donna Turner got this idea from somewhere. And if John Johnson didn't suggest in his closing arguments that Donnie Barentine and Dennis Perry had done this crime together, well, then you can kiss my grits. The real mystery to me is why Donna Turner is the only juror we've talked to who was convinced Barentine had been at the scene. Given the immunity agreement, it's the only explanation that really makes sense. But one reason he was so forgettable may have been because what happened during deliberations. It all goes back to the foreman of the jury and his interpretation of what Donna Turner called the box.
But this wasn't his first murder trial, and for a lot of us, it was.
It usually is.
Yes. And he really kind of orchestrated stuff. And we would bring in a lot of things that we weren't allowed to bring in. You know, well, but you got to think about this. Well, we can't use that. We have to deal with exactly what this fact is. Now, I think he's guilty.
As Donna Turner remembers it, the foreman's interpretation of evidentiary rules meant that you could only consider exactly what was before you, nothing else. It's out of the box, you can't look at it.
Did you ever discuss Barentine with him?
We did discuss Barentine some.
What did you say?
We can't consider him at all. He was granted immunity and he's not on trial.
He told you can't consider him as a suspect?
That we couldn't consider him in this trial.
Hearing Donna Turner, all I can think of now is the foreman's experiences in the other trial he'd been on, the Jimmy Metters trial. In that trial, the foreman had actually tried looking outside the box. He'd tried asking about police reports for the Highway 303 shooting. And he'd been slapped down. The court had said, no, just consider what's directly before you and nothing else. Because prosecutor John Johnson had buried the evidence of the Highway 303 police reports. And the jury foreman had learned his lesson. Because prosecutor John Johnson had buried the evidence of the Highway 303 police reports, the jury foreman had learned his lesson, that he wasn't supposed to take into consideration any evidence that might exist but wasn't there in court. And after learning this lesson in the Metters trial, the foreman had brought it with him to Dennis Perry's trial.
You've got to focus on what was presented, what we can use, and you got to forget the rest.
And you can't use Barentine.
Right. Can't use Barentine.
Did anyone question him on this or push back or ask him why they...
No. No. Everybody felt like, oh, well, you've been on a murder trial before, so hey.
There's something else, too, in the file that shows that this theory that Barentine and Dennis Perry did it together was what John Johnson believed had happened. It's in one of those snarky letters from John Johnson to the defense attorneys, and there's a line that I keep going back to. Johnson is responding to a letter from defense counsel Dale Wessling, where Dale Wessling complained about how Johnson hadn't handed over some critical info on Donnie Barentine and Jeff Kittrell. And in Johnson's letter, it has this throwaway line. It says,
actually, there is an explanation of the facts of this case that would make all the witnesses and you and I to tell the truth. Maybe that will come out in the trial. Who knows?
An explanation of the facts that would make all the witnesses and the prosecution and the defense be telling the truth? That doesn't exist. It's not possible. But if John Johnson thought it was possible, it must be because he believed that both Donnie Barentine and Dennis Perry were guilty of this murder. And despite this, John Johnson was fine with Donnie Barentine walking free, just so long as it meant that John Johnson got Dennis Perry. I would like to take a moment here to point out just how insane this theory is. Donnie Barentine's connection to Georgia is through his cousin, Greg Barentine, who'd once lived in Waverly before moving a few miles north to Waynesville. Donnie worked for Greg, who was fairly high-ranking in this organization, such as it was. They called themselves the Dixie Mafia, and they were drug traffickers. The organization that Greg Barentine mostly worked with was based out of Wilkes County, North Carolina, but they had contacts all over the South, including all up and down the Georgia coast. And the alleged motive for why Barentine's group would have been targeting Harold and Thelma Swain, at least according to some of the witnesses that investigators have spoken to over the years, has to do with one of the Swains' relatives, a guy named Lawrence Brown. He was also a drug trafficker. 3 weeks after the Swains were killed, he was arrested when customs found that he was trafficking a lot of marijuana into the port of Savannah. And it was this relative who allegedly turned informant. And the story goes that since the Dixie Mafia couldn't find Lawrence Brown, they decided to deliver a message to the Swains instead. But Dennis Perry is not Dixie Mafia, Dennis Perry wouldn't last a day in Dixie Mafia. Dennis Perry wouldn't last an hour. Donnie Barentine was part of an organized and sophisticated operation working with Colombian cartels to move tens of thousands of pounds of marijuana and basically plane loads of cocaine across the national borders. Plus a few million quaaludes here and there and maybe some light arms trafficking, just for good measure. Meanwhile, Dennis Perry's record is for things like having an open container on the beach. If you think Donnie Barentine's group would ever use Dennis Perry to carry out a hit, well, I've got a bunch of Southeast Georgia swampland to sell you.
All of this would have been news to the jury, by the way. There was nothing about Donnie Barentine's Dixie Mafia ties that came out at Dennis Perry's trial. The name Lawrence Brown was never mentioned. The jury would have had no clue whatsoever about any motivation that the Barentine's group could have had to kill the Swains. But even if the jury didn't get to hear about it, there is a little bit we do know about this drug trafficking ring. That's because from 1980 onwards, it was under investigations, plural. There were a lot of investigations going on by a lot of agencies. The DEA, FBI, Customs, GBI, NCSI, the FDLE, pretty much any law enforcement acronym you can think of was keeping an eye on these guys one way or another. And all of them were trying to build cases against the traffickers. They were having some success, too. The summer of 1982 was a particularly bad time for Barentine's gang, and many involved in the operation were either arrested or got indicted and went on the run. And that's why, in June of 1982, Greg Barentine tried to turn informant. I say tried because ultimately the investigators would turn him down on the offer. The government had tons of informants within the Wilkes County group already, and they didn't need Greg Barentine to make their case. Thanks, but no thanks, they told him. But before investigators had turned him down for good, Greg had tried to convince them of his value as an informant. He handed over materials that he thought would be helpful to them, things that might help put together a case. Things like his personal phone directory with the names and contact information of people the investigators might be interested in knowing about.
It's a fascinating list of people, sort of a glimpse into the social networks of a cocaine smuggler from the 1980s. In general, though, there are not a lot of great reasons for your name to be on this list. If your name is on there, there's a real good chance you were involved in the drug conspiracy, at least on a part-time basis. Maybe you were a shrimp boat captain who didn't always haul shrimp. Or if you weren't involved in the drug side, you were probably someone who knows Greg Barentine for other not-so-great reasons. Like someone from the dog fighting rings. Or, say, a veterinarian that treats dogs from the fighting rings. Names and contact information that Greg Barentine thought he could use to try and buy himself a lighter prison sentence. Which is why, when I read through it, there was one name on that list that made me stop in my tracks. Because I recognized it. It was the name of a juror from Dennis Perry's trial. And the phone number beside the name was the same as the home phone number linked back to that juror. Now, fast forward several months, and I was able to figure out this name, the one on Greg Barentine's phone list, it was not referring to the juror himself. But it was that juror's father. Which meant I really, really needed to talk to the juror to find out if there was anything more going on here. Especially since I knew from talking to other jurors that this juror had been one who was particularly gung-ho about Dennis Perry's guilt. So I did talk to the juror, and he told me he hadn't known about any business that his father may have had with the Barentines. He also told me that he never once discussed Dennis Perry's trial with his father either. In fact, he told me that he didn't even recall that there had been an alternate suspect in the Dennis Perry case. I have no reason not to believe the juror. As far as I know, I was the first one to ever break the news to him that his father might not have always been the completely upstanding businessman that he'd always believed him to be. But still, it is hugely disconcerting to me to know that this man had gotten onto the jury in the first place. Dennis Perry's defense was that Greg Barentine's drug trafficking ring was responsible for the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain. No one who had close family members that were connected to this drug ring should have ever made onto that jury. Or at the very least, there should have been some token effort made to stop anyone like that from getting on the jury. Again, we don't have the voir dire transcripts, but as far as I've been able to tell, there was no attempt made during jury selection to identify whether any jurors were connected to people that the defense attorneys were planning to blame for the murders. This, clearly, in light of the one juror, was not some hypothetical concern. Greg Barentine had many contacts in the Brunswick area, and the defense attorneys should have known this. They had or should have had documents that show just how active Greg Barentine's drug trafficking ring was in Brunswick. Heck, the defense should have had documents that showed how Greg Barentine's drug ring had a major stash location just 4 miles down US 17 from Rising Daughter. And not only did the defense attorneys make no effort to explain to the jury anything about this drug ring or its potential relevance to the Swain case, the defense attorneys didn't even make the most basic of efforts to make sure people connected to the drug ring didn't end up on Dennis Perry's jury. That's all for episode 18 of Undisclosed, The State versus Dennis Perry. We'll be back on Monday with episode 19, and we'll resume our regular schedule after that. Mithil Tilhan is our executive producer, and our logo is designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production for this episode is done by Hannah McCarthy. You can find trial transcripts and case-related materials on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com, and transcripts of this episode and previous episodes are also available. They're prepared by transcriber team Britta Bliss, Don Logis, Erica Fladell, and Skylar Park. Thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Don't forget to follow us online. On all social media, our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Dennis Perry's case, we'd love to hear from you. Please reach out. You can contact us by email at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or by phone and leave us a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.